I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is the artist Ian Falconer. He's the author and illustrator of the Olivia children's book series about a pig inspired by his niece, also named Olivia. The first Olivia, published in 2000, won the Caldecott Award, among other accolades. Ian is a set and costume designer for opera and dance, and he's created numerous covers for the New Yorker magazine since 1996. Welcome.
Thank you.
Could you describe what your home looks like in New York City, in the West Village?
Did you ever read... Which is the book? Is it Our Mutual Friend? It's the one with Jarndyce and Jarndyce, and there's the Rag and Bone Man shop with all this... Just everything is stacked to the ceilings. Books piled up 4 feet high. It's a mess. It's a complete mess. And I work in there and live in there and entertain in there. It's a wonderful 1950s. I think they were built as kind of bachelor pads in the 50s. Very, very streamlined. It's a staircase that comes down with a wraparound balustrade. But it's all buried now. It's very clean lines, but it's all completely buried. I don't know what this is. It's like living in a boat in New York. I have to have paper and paints and a lot of materials and a lot of reference books, and I have tons of music and tons of CDs, DVDs. And
when you say that you also entertain in there, do you feel the inclination to clean up before your guests come? What kind of entertaining do you do in there?
Not much anymore, but I used to actually have a grand piano in the living room, and I used to have concerts. Friends would come over and perform, and we'd invite maybe 30, 40, 50 people. There's actually no room to do that anymore. The neighbors complain, too.
You worked on Olivia in your bedroom on an easel, and there's a quote you once said.
Yes, I had a one-room studio apartment at that point, so there was nothing but the bed.
Yeah, and you said at one point, I nearly had a nervous breakdown. I'd go to bed staring at the work, then wake up with it.
Yes. You need a lot of floor space. People are always saying, why don't you get a dog? Paper, floor, dog, nah.
What is your ideal workspace?
Ideally, I would like to have a whole townhouse where I could have office space in the basement and then two floors to live on and two floors to work on.
Mm.
And separate space for doing sculpture and stuff like that.
Mm.
And theater design, which is really messy, and other space for painting and drawing. So
somehow I think you might fill that space with
too. I would. I think,
What is your work habit? Are you working during the day?
Yeah, I tend to work a lot at night. Start about 5 in the evening and then work till 4 in the morning or something. It's the only time the phone doesn't ring. It's quiet.
What time did you wake up this morning?
9:30. Well, I didn't get to sleep until 7, so.
Until 7 a.m.
So you. I have a trouble getting to sleep when I know I have to do something the next day.
Yes.
Like get on a plane or go to the dentist or be interviewed on. At least it's not live.
And do you find that the public part of your work like a distraction?
Oh, absolutely. I find it an absolute pain in the neck. Very distracting. Yeah, I can't do anything else. Well, they were really smart. Nobody told me about it. Nobody reminded me about this until last night. So I didn't have 3 days to go sweat.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Ian Falconer, the creator of the children's book series Olivia, about a precocious pig. You are an artist in various mediums. You do costume and set design. You've been the author and illustrator for Olivia. You create New Yorker magazine covers. When you were younger and you had aspirations to be an artist, did you have a vision of, one of those vehicles for expressing your art?
I always liked doing lots of different things. My father was a wonderful amateur carpenter. He could build anything, shelves, cabinetry. He was an architect. And he had a great shop, which he let me play in all the time. So I learned very early how to make things. And I don't know what my mother must have thought. I mean, a 6-year-old kid using a radial arm saw is a little terrifying. Drill presses and a lathe. We had a lathe. It could turn candlesticks and things. Really dangerous. Essentially, we say, oh, he does theater and draws and paints. But essentially, that's much the same thing. It all involves drawing.
You grew up in Ridgefield, Connecticut, right? Ridgewood.
No, I was born in Ridgefield, but I was actually moved from there when I was about 4. We moved to an island off the coast of Connecticut in Long Island Sound, just half a mile offshore. It was absolutely idyllic, very beautiful. It's called Tavern Island. It's just our house, one house.
And how did your family come to live on an island, and how did you end up being the only family on that island, or the only house on that island?
It was an old house. It's a turn-of-the-century house, and we'd always sailed around it, and my parents saw it came up for sale. It used to be owned by Billy Rose, the great Broadway impresario, and it was very silly. It had Italian sculptures of muses and putti, little babies and things all over it, and peacocks, and huge amount of animals. We had a huge amount of animals, which may be why I'm so good at anthropomorphizing my pig. We had at one point 18 peacocks, 4 guinea fowl, ringneck pheasants, golden pheasants, birds, and because we'd feed them, we also got all the neighborhood ducks and geese that would come and just plop themselves on the lawn. And then there were all the abandoned ducklings that we got re-raised. And there was, at one point, my sister had found 5 ducklings that were with no mother, and they printed on her and would follow her around in a little train like ducklings do, and it was so adorable. We had this circle of chicken wire that we put on the beach in the water so they could swim without escaping and be protected from other creatures, and one of them got caught, its head got caught, and the tide was coming in, and it was not breathing, and I held its bill closed and I gave it mouth-to-mouth resuscitation, and it lived. And my sister thought I was a hero from then on.
It sounds idyllic and great material for your work. Did your parents make a conscious decision to give you, this eclectic way of life? Or was it just, of course, this is what we're going to do, is have 18 peacocks?
Well, they were there on the island when we got it.
You grew up there with your 2 sisters, Tonya and Victoria, as well as your parents. Your father was a carpenter and architect. And what did your mother do?
She actually taught art sometimes, and she ran a sailing school, and we're always involved with boats, so that's, I suppose, why we ended up on an island.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Ian Falconer, the creator of the children's book series Olivia, about a precocious pig. In addition to creating the book series, he's designed sets and costumes for the New York City Ballet, the San Francisco Opera, the Royal Opera House in London, and the Théâtre du Châtelet in Paris. Ian also creates covers for the New Yorker magazine. So fast forward, was there any question that you would do anything else with your life other than make art?
Well, my parents didn't like the idea that much because it's hard to make a living as an artist. So I was sent to NYU and I did art history and then flunked out after 2 years because I really didn't want to be an art historian at all. Then I went to Parsons.
In New York City?
Yeah.
Can you talk to me some more about the early period when you were at NYU having a difficult moment in your life when you were studying art history and all you wanted to do was make art? Like, what was the what was the 18-year-old Ian Falconer like?
Well, I would still make things, even though I wasn't in an art school. But as my father said, well, he's majoring in Studio 45, intentionally getting it wrong. I was a wild 18-year-old, yeah. I got to New York from a boarding school in Massachusetts, believe me.
All right, so you were majoring in Studio 54.
It was really, really fun. It was a time in New York when the uptown people and the downtown people all mixed together in a different way. And now the downtown people all live in Brooklyn separate. And it was a much more vibrant, wild city than it is now. And it was amazing looking around a room and seeing, well, there's Frank Perdue, and there's Martha Graham, and there's Barbara Streisand, and there's Liza Minnelli, and there's everybody was there. Everybody was doing cocaine at that time, from museum directors, socialites, not just kids. It was everybody passing around little vials at dinner parties and things. No food got eaten.
Did drugs fuel your creativity even at that time?
No. It's a waste of time.
Okay, so during this time, after leaving NYU, you went to Parsons Art School in New York City.
Yeah, and I met a lot of people in the art world, and through one of them, Henry Geldzahler, who used to be the Commissioner of Cultural Affairs, I met David Hockney. He said he offered me work out in Los Angeles, and they have a sister school, Parsons Otis Art Institute, in Los Angeles, so I transferred out there and worked for him for about 13 years.
Now, David Hockney, the artist.
The artist, yes.
Was also, he was creating sets.
He was doing, yeah.
For theater and opera in Los Angeles.
Yes, that's what I was working with him on. So I got really good training through that.
Berated.
In the studio and in the theater.
And you collaborated with David professionally, and you also were his boyfriend for a few years. Is that,
mm-hmm.
is that right?
At the beginning, yeah.
How long were you partners as well?
Oh, I don't know. Does it ever really end? I'm still in touch with him all the time, and I love him dearly.
Describe that experience for me of creating and set designing.
Well, music has always been very important to me. So working on the operas and the ballet was... Ballet, not so much, but the opera is thrilling. Learning from David, he would always say, if you're stuck for an idea, listen to the music, love. Listen to the music. And he always take it back to the music, which a lot of designers don't.
Would you listen to the music as you were designing to give you inspiration?
Can mm-hmm.
you
over and over again. Every available recording we could find of the thing we would play.
What's an example of one of the projects you worked on with him?
Tristan and Isolde, mm-hmm. Turandot, which is still in circulation, plays a lot. Die Frau in Schatten, which is a Strauss opera.
So David was a real mentor. What are some things that he taught you, whether it's about the world of art or
Well, he's
the
very
work.
Passionate about art, so yes, I learned a lot about painting. But technically, as he says, it's that an art school can't teach you art. It can only teach you how to use a pencil and a brush and oil paints. And it can only teach you techniques, really. It's up to you to make the art. He draws constantly, all the time. They're always interesting, and he's tireless.
In a way, creating sets for opera or ballet is very three-dimensional, and a lot of your work, though, has also been, on the page.
Mm-hmm.
How do you think about that?
I tend to do painted drop sets, so they're layers of illusionistic painting and not built sets. One reason is because when you build a set, you tend to be stuck with that set, whereas when you have drop sets, you can change it instantly, and you can have many, many, many different scene changes, which people love.
And in a way, it's more of connective tissue to the books and the magazines because it's a little more two-dimensional
mm-hmm.
in a way.
But you can get some great three-dimensional illusions that way, forcing perspective and all that.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is the artist Ian Falconer. We'll hear more from Ian coming up. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is the artist Ian Falconer. He's the author and illustrator of the Olivia children's book series about a pig inspired by his niece, also named Olivia. The first Olivia, published in 2000, won the Caldecott Award, among other accolades. Ian is a set and costume designer for opera and dance, and he's created numerous covers for the New Yorker magazine since 1996. So moving forward from your life in Los Angeles, designing sets with David Hockney, to New York, where you created Olivia in your Greenwich Village apartment, what was the impetus for moving back to New York City?
My lease was up in Los Angeles, and I thought, do I want to move to another house here? Or do I was actually only going to spend maybe 6 months back in New York. My family's all here, so I thought it'd be nice, and I ended up staying.
Were you feeling, satisfied professionally, or were you feeling like, I have a book in me, or what was your...
I was actually a bit at a loss because I had a gallery in Los Angeles, but I didn't have a gallery in New York, and my paintings were not fashionable at that time.
What did they look like?
I do portraits and landscapes and interiors and still lifes. Having worked with David Hockney all those years, I'd known art dealers for a long time, and they're a funny breed. I remember going to Robert Miller Gallery, I think, and it was his assistant at that point who saw me, and he didn't like my stuff, and so he suggested that I go to another gallery that handled Peter Schlesinger, one of David Hockney's old boyfriends. Mm. And I thought that was the worst put down. Go to David's ex-boyfriend gallery. I wasn't quite sure what to do, and I thought, well, I've got to make some money. So I'll send in some things to the New Yorker magazine. And amazingly, they liked my work, which is a dream for an illustrator. Any illustrator would like that job.
Did you have any connections at the New Yorker, or you just pretty much put your material in an envelope, put a stamp on it, and sent it in?
I had a friend who knew somebody who knew a guy named David Kuhn who worked with Tina Brown.
Who was the former editor.
And I came and gave them to him. He didn't seem very impressed with them, and I did think he didn't want to get me to get my hopes up or anything. But so all I can do is show them to the editor, and my editor, Françoise Mouly, who is wonderful. I didn't hear anything from them, and I finally thought, well, I'll write a note and just say, I haven't gotten my drawings back. If you have any suggestions, I'd love to hear them. Mm-hmm. And this is my phone number. And the next day she called me up and said, oh, darling, hello, I do want you to come up and see my office, see what's on the wall. They didn't use any of the drawings I sent them, but it took me almost a year to get my first cover, but it did support me. They were very generous at that time. They used to buy in things even if they didn't use them. And it was while I was doing that, Olivia was born, and she was the first kid in the family.
Now, this was in 1996, and you were in your mid to late 30s when the New Yorker picked you up. What was the first cover that you did for the New Yorker?
It was 4th of July, and it was an image of the arm of the Statue of Liberty, and she's holding a sparkler instead of a torch. Not the best joke in the world, but it was a nice visual.
The New Yorker paid you up front each year so that it mm-hmm. freed you up to not only create for the New Yorker, but to work on various other projects, including Olivia.
And theater, yeah. And I started doing Olivia so I would have more time to paint. But as I've lived in New York, every year it's gotten so much more expensive over the last 15 years that I kept having to do more books.
Right.
I was trying to buy a studio at one point, and then the housing market all fell apart. So eventually, I think the next book might be called Olivia Pays the Rent.
The inspiration for Olivia, the book series, is your niece, Olivia Crane, mm-hmm. who lives in Connecticut. When did you first think to create a gift for your niece? Because it was a gift initially, right?
Yes. I started drawing this little character and putting it together, and I realized that it was actually pretty good, really kind of funny. The character was very funny, and I took it into William Morris Agency. They had a children's book department. The woman there said, I like it. I like the drawings, but it's not an Eloise yet. It's not an Eloise. And okay. She said, well, we'll hook you up with another. It's your first time author. You'll never get published without. I'll put you together with an established author. And no, I don't want it to be illustrated by Ian Falcon. I've created this character. So I took it home and put it away. And then I got a call from somebody at Simon & Schuster, from Ann Schwartz, who'd seen my New Yorker stuff and said, would you like to illustrate a children's book? And I said, here you go. I brought her the illustration. She loved it, absolutely loved it. That was it.
Describe to me how you felt when you got that call. These are momentous pivot points in your life, whether it was the New Yorker saying, yeah, come on in, or Anne saying, I love the work. Like,
well, I get very, very, very shy about showing my work. So I remember going up there absolutely terrified. Not terrified, but shaky and nervous. And Anne said, we were actually really worried about you when we first we thought, who is this creature that we've that we're getting involved with here?
You mean when they saw you for the first time?
Yeah.
In person. Why? How would you describe what you're like in person?
I tend to get sort of shaky and jittery, nervous, very nervous. You're making me nervous right now. Just talking about it is making me nervous. It was great, but I didn't have that high hopes for it even when they said yes, because thousands of children's books come out every year, and many of them just go under the radar. They don't get noticed. They were terrific, Simon & Schuster. They put a lot of advertising behind it, and it became very popular. And the Caldecott, of course. That was very funny because they called me at, I think, about 8 o'clock in the morning. I was in a deep slumber, and they said, guess what? You've won the Caldecott medal. And I was like, oh, great. Thank you. Thank you. I don't think it even really occurred to me what the Caldecott was and how important it was. I soon found out when some of my children's book writing friends started steaming about it.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Ian Falconer, the creator of the children's book series Olivia, about a precocious pig. How would you describe who Olivia is? What's her personality?
She's confident, very confident. Seems to know what she wants. She's contrarian, so just when you think you know what she's going to do next, she'll surprise you by doing the opposite. She wants to do everything herself. She wants to make everything herself. She has a strong imagination.
You mentioned that you had a lot of animals around the house, which is why you might be good at anthropomorphizing in your work. Did you ever think Olivia, the pig, might be a different animal? How did pig come to mind?
Olivia has this very turned-up little nose, and when she was a little kid, you know, little kids, their heads are always a little bit too big for their bodies, and she just looked like a little piglet. Pigs are also very intelligent. Considering they only have trotters, apparently they can get into any cabinet or anything. They're very clever.
The palette for Olivia is spare. There's sort of an economy in the colors that you use.
I think too much color, too much detail, too much stuff distracts from the story. I think that the simplicity of the way Olivia is drawn allows you to see, really concentrate on her facial expressions, which I work very hard on, her facial expressions, to get it. It's just a tiny little dot for the eye, but you have to get it right, and you end up erasing it over and over and over again, and just to get the right surprise or whatever the look is on her face. I have a sort of technique that I developed for these books. People always think that they're airbrushed, but they're not. I get those women's makeup tools, you know, those cotton balls and cotton swabs and things to do the shadowing, to give this delicate, soft shadowing, and then outline it with charcoal. Then you paint on the gouache, and then you can shade the gouache with the charcoal as well to get that three-dimensional quality. And then the shadow underneath her feet so that she seems to stand on a plane on the floor.
You use the same economy, not just in the palette, but in the language. The words are so simpatico with the art.
I found when I'm working on other illustrating things for other people that I don't have that same feeling of the organic whole of doing the books myself and writing them. And when you're working on the books with the editor at the stage where you've got all the drawings and you're working with the text, you'll keep changing the text and altering things, which if you're with an author, sometimes they never even meet these authors and illustrators, and you wonder, what the hell? Collaborate. A lot of people have trouble collaborating. That's the great thing about theater, is you learn how to collaborate with other people. You have to work with them, or or else.
Who are some children's authors or illustrators whom you're particularly fond of? Or whom you think about as reference points for you?
I love Maurice Sendak, of course. He's truly a giant. His book, and oddly enough, a lot of people don't like it as much as his other books, but is Higgledy Piggledy Pop, if you've ever read it. First of all, it's all in black and white. It's all, I think, pencil or charcoal, graphite or charcoal, I'm not sure. And it's a wonderfully dark tale for children, surreal dark tale for children. Mm-hmm. Dr. Seuss, absolutely. And again, those old two-color printing processes that they used to use, a lot of the early Dr. Seuss books, it's only one color and black and white because it was cheaper. It was very expensive to do a four-color lithograph at that time. Mm-hmm. It's not now. In fact, Olivia's black and white drawings are all done in four-color, five-color, I think it is, so that to get the richness in the charcoal, because charcoal has a lovely warmth to it.
Does the stripe of her sweater at all reference the stripe of the Cat in the Hat, the cat's hat?
No. First of all, stripes delineate the shape of the body wonderfully. They show bulges and all the curves and shapes in the body. But I always liked stripes, whether they're fisherman's stripes, fisherman's shirts, and things like that.
We talk about David Hockney as being an important figure in your life. What other artists have had an impact on you?
Not many living artists that I can think of right now. Certainly, I've been influenced by the large figures of the 20th century, Picasso and Matisse. And, well, I don't know how you could not be influenced by Picasso. And he had this extraordinary facility from a very early age, which allowed him to do anything, pretty much anything he wanted. He could paint like a 50-year-old man when he was 10. His father was a painter and painted little pictures for tourists of pigeons, doves. And Picasso, I don't know, 3 years old or something, copied one of his father's paintings and did it so well that his father just put down his brushes and said, "You do it now."
You mentioned Picasso and Matisse, I think of as an explosion of color.
No, very controlled, though. It's very hard to use color, and he does it beautifully. So does Hockney.
Even though Olivia is not soaked in color.
It reads as color, though. It doesn't read as, to me, it doesn't read as a black and white book. The first book does have just one color. The second book has a cup, like red and pink. And the third book has green and red, but it's tightly controlled.
There's also an appeal for adults in Olivia. And some say that it was an instant success because parents liked Olivia. For instance, there's references to Maria Callas and, of course, Degas and Jackson Pollock in the first Olivia and later Eleanor Roosevelt. And to what extent are you kind of winking at parents concurrently while you're also trying to appeal to the little people?
There are a couple things. One is the parents frequently have to read these books over and over and over again because kids love repetition. They love being able to anticipate. They know what's coming next. The other thing is, I think when the child and the parent are bonding together reading, it really helps if the parent laughs, because children will laugh at what their parents want, and they'll also try and figure out what their parents are laughing at. I think it helps.
You created this initially as a gift for your niece, Olivia, and obviously it's become much larger than that. To what extent has your family gotten involved in this?
My niece, it's very funny. Olivia never... She just took it all... I guess as children do, that she just took it all in stride. Of course, there's a book about me. she used to autograph them for kids at school. In fact, I was doing a book signing once when she was the first book, and she was very little. And she came up and just without being asked, sat down next to me and started just signing in a big, slow O L I. And there are people lined up for, 300 people deep back there waiting, and Olivia's just. It's very cute.
I could see for other families who may not want to have a public presence, you have made them public in a way that maybe they might not have expected.
But I don't think many people outside of her school or her friend circle know that she's that Olivia. Town library, maybe.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Ian Falconer, the creator of the children's book series Olivia, About a Pig. The series exists in almost 30 languages, and Olivia debuted in 2009 on Nickelodeon as a TV series. Ian has also designed sets and costumes for various opera and ballet companies, and he's worked in collaboration with the essayist David Sedaris on a stage version of Santaland Diaries, among other projects. I want to talk about Tom Ford for a minute. He's a fashion designer, and he's also the director of the movie A Single Man by Isherwood. You were partners with Tom Ford.
Yeah, we met at NYU. We were in the same class at NYU.
One of the reasons I bring him up is in his movie, the lead character is a gentleman, George, and George's last name in the movie is Falconer. You being somebody kind of private have been the object. You've been now on the other side, in a way, by being George Falconer. You are Falconer.
Yes, there's no last name in the book, so he needed to invent one for the screen, and that was very sweet of him, very, very sweet of him.
What role did he play in your life? I assume, are you still friends? And
yes.
You both obviously met each other at a very formative stage, both very young at NYU. How do you think you have influenced each other's lives or careers, if at all?
I'm not sure we have that much. He's been a wonderful friend, but we're very different people.
You're both in the milieu of meeting other artists and...
But he's always immaculate and put together, and his house is absolutely pristine, clean, crisp. And I'm a slob and messy. He's very social. I'm not. Cares what he looks like. I don't. I have 6 white Brooks Brothers shirts and 6 pairs of blue jeans, and that's makes it so much easier.
Incidentally, there are a number of children's books created by single men who don't have children. Maurice Sendak comes to mind.
Yes.
Where the Wild Things Are. Do you think it's just coincidence, or you know, talk to me about that. You don't have children.
No. Mm-hmm. I don't know. That is an odd thing. I hadn't thought of that. I think possibly that single middle-aged men have never grown up themselves and maintain a kind of attachment to childhood that other people may not have when they've married and are saddled with children, and they also may not have time to the luxury of time to sit and think and draw and diddle and doodle. I used to have a macrobiotic teacher in California during one of my one of my California health things, and she always said that gay men have made some subconscious decision not to take responsibility. And I bristle at that, but more and more I think maybe she's a little bit right there. They tend to postpone adolescence into their 50s.
You mentioned macrobiotics. Are you focused on eating well? And
I try, but it's not that easy in New York City. Maybe it's my neighborhood.
The West Village.
The West Village. Mm-hmm. Tends to be either high-end or pizza.
Ernest Hemingway says, he talks about doing the best work on an empty stomach.
I often don't eat until dinner. Mm-hmm. Keeps you sharper. Yeah, it does.
Well, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
My guest has been the artist Ian Falconer. Coming up, we'll hear from Michael and Rick Mast, founders of Mast Brothers Chocolate. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guests are Michael and Rick Mast, founders of Mast Brothers Chocolate, an American craft chocolate company located in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. They were pioneers behind making chocolate from the actual bean to the bar, and they're part of a group of food artisans who produce their own cheese and chocolate and knives and meats, and they're part of a local barter community in Williamsburg. Welcome, Michael. Welcome, Rick.
Yeah, thanks so much for having us.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Before we get started, I just want our listeners to know what I'm looking at, which is two brothers who have massive beards. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering how long it's taken you to get your beards to the length that they are.
Well, originally, we sort of made a wager with ourselves when we first decided to do this. We made a wager that after we would make and sell successfully 1,000 chocolate bars, we were not going to shave. And by the time that happened, we were sort of accustomed to them, and they were sort of part of who we are, and we thought it sort of symbolized what we do, so we keep them, much to our wives, my wife and his girlfriend's dismay. Yeah.
We held true to that, and it took about maybe 8 months before we sold our first 1,000 bars.
How would you describe what Mast Brothers Chocolate is?
Well, simply we describe it as American craft chocolate, a sort of term that goes beyond just being a slogan. Just taking pride in one's work as a craftsman or a craftswoman, you know, that it's not just for my brother and I, but it's for the people that work with us in our factory. It's also just people that work in our community, in our food artisan community, and beyond food artisan community. It's being a part of a community of furniture makers. You know, there's a resurgence in furniture makers. There's a great knife maker in Brooklyn. There's all sorts of great cheese makers, beer makers, wine makers. So whether it's, you know, from woodworking to food, it's a sort of self-dependence and a pride in what you make with your hands.
Rick, before you were making chocolate with Michael, your brother, what were you doing?
I was working in kitchens and restaurants all around New York. Worked briefly at Gramercy Tavern. Worked briefly at Soho House. Worked briefly under Jacques Torres.
Gramercy Tavern, which is owned by Danny Meyer, the restaurateur, and Jacques Torres. He's a chocolate maker.
So what we do is make the chocolate that maybe someday he would use to make his confections with. We are the tree grower or the logger to somebody else, to a carpenter's, you know, creation of something they would make with wood, you know.
And before you were working in the culinary life, what were you doing?
Before that, I was a classical musician. I studied piano and composition and was obsessed with opera. And I always dreamt of actually using a similar approach and mentality and vision to what we're applying to chocolate with opera. I always thought that opera was the ultimate liberal arts education. That's what I'd always say. You can learn everything about life by working in an opera.
Why do you say that's the case for opera, and how is that then carried on to your making of chocolate?
Well, with opera, you're learning about languages, you're learning about history, you're learning about physical building of sets, you're learning about math with the composition of scores, you're learning so much, and you're working with the team, all of that. Well, I think that, which you just learn about the necessities of life. Food, shelter, music, art, those are the things, family, friends, those are the things you need in life. So to sort of be a proponent of it that, and really push it out there to the public about how beautiful it can be and how important it is and how pure it can be, it doesn't have to be so complicated. That's important to me. I'm not sure if I made sense there, but I tried to in a roundabout kind of way.
I think it does.
Yeah.
How did you decide to go from opera to chocolate?
Well, it was opera to food, music to food. So my brother was living in New York. I was living in California at the time. And I decided to move out to New York and crashed on my brother's couch and started getting into food. Started first, just briefly worked at a local restaurant in Williamsburg, and then decided after about a week or two of that I need to study and really work at this like I worked at classical music. So then I went to culinary school.
Michael, what were you doing before starting this company?
Well, I originally came out here after I graduated from college in 2001, and my goal was to work in independent films and maybe one day be a film producer. And so my path was working in production and in financing and accounting for different films or TV shows.
You're both from Iowa. What did your parents do in Iowa?
Our mother works for the dean of the graduate college at the University of Iowa, and our father passed away a few years ago.
Yeah, our father was a carpenter, and but he fought in Vietnam and went through the shit, as they say. So he had lots of problems, and our mom was always sort of a champ and raised us on her own. We have an older sister as well.
What influence did you have from them, if any, in the path you chose? I mean, yes, your father was a carpenter, so there's that obvious link with working with your hands.
Mm-hmm. And that's about it. I think that what our mother taught us was self-reliance and work ethic. I think that it goes beyond stereotype that Iowa boys work harder than everybody else. Mike and I have a sort of unwavering work ethic that we wake up, no matter how much we fought or how whatever happened in our personal lives, we'll always wake up and get the job done and work, you know, pretty devastatingly exhausting hours.
What was that moment when you both said, Rick, you're living on Michael's couch, and you said, okay, we're going to start this chocolate company. How come it wasn't cheese or milk or butter?
Well, I think that it could easily have been cheese or butter. I'm interested in all of them, and we both are interested in all of them. It was chocolate specifically, because chocolate is probably far and away so associated with American culture because of such a favorite food of Americans. And so when we were searching out, we're like, oh, how is chocolate made exactly? After learning about how to make cheese and all these other things, chocolate was the next on the list. So how do you make chocolate? Well, let's go ask. So we'd go to shop after shop after shop, and they'd say, how is chocolate? I would ask them how chocolate was made, and they would say, well, we put the chocolate in this tempering machine, and then we make these, you know, various shapes or bonbons or truffles. And we're like, no, how is the chocolate made? Chocolate doesn't grow on trees. It's a recipe of, it's what happens after you make something. Mm-hmm. So that's when we realized, no one knows, and no one is doing it in all of New York City. New York City? So we were just like, wow, this is insane.
Why do you think no one else in New York City was making chocolate from the bean?
Well, I think that from a business perspective, the profit margins aren't exactly through the roof. You could make a lot more money selling truffles and bonbons and confections than you can making it from the bean. It also, there's no such thing as commercial equipment for it. You can't say, I'm going to start a small chocolate company and then go online and get a couple machines. Almost all the machines that we started with were made for something else. For instance, our first granite stone grinder that we used was made to grind rice, and it was sourced from India. And we had to do some alterations to it for it to be used for chocolate. So it truly is a start from scratch, including the equipment.
We talk about how craftsmanlike you are, and it seems like such an ironically novel concept, you know, in the 21st century, when really you're just getting back to the very fabric of human existence, and it's amazing how far we've moved from that.
It's incredible, yeah. People go on, now they go on Brooklyn food tours, and people come with their cameras around their necks, and they're like, look, these people are making chocolate from scratch. We're going to go to the butcher and watch him butcher meat. Wow. You know, it's like,
we really just wanted to simplify everything, too, and that's why we're so open about what we're doing and how we have an open factory, just so people can really see what's going on, and there's no mystery behind it, or there's no mystery in the ingredients or the process.
Could you just walk me through briefly the process, how you are going from bean to bar?
We source our beans currently from Madagascar, from Brazil, from Venezuela, and from Dominican Republic. We also have a relationship with some farms in Belize. And when I mention these countries, it isn't just a country. We have specific farms from each country. After we get the beans, we actually just have a big butcher block table. We spread the beans out on there, and we sort through them by hand. We literally go through each bean and anything that, any piece of bark, any piece of just empty husk, any stone, we sort out. After that, we roast the beans. It's a very delicate roast. And we roast in an oven that we got from a restaurant called Marlowe & Sons, which is sort of a community hub for food artisans. And we just traded it for chocolate. So it's just really awesome to live in a community where you can, that's possible.
To barter.
Yeah, exactly. After that, we crack all of the beans by hand. We took an old piece of, an old grinder or a mill that is commonly used for breaking up barley when you're making home brew, when you're making beer. Then we have to separate the husk from the bean. So we collaborated with a friend of ours who has a business in Red Hook. He's actually an engineer, like an aerospace engineer. So in his, you know, in his side project, for while he's building equipment for satellites, he's just a young guy like us, you know, that's up to no good, you know. So he is collaborating with us to build this winnower, and by winnower I mean a contraption that separates the husk from the meat of the bean, and it's beautiful. After that, you have the cocoa nibs. So,
and the nibs are what are inside the husks.
Absolutely, yep. Mm-hmm. And that's the basis, the foundation of all chocolate. So we have these beautiful granite stone grinders, which is basically a mechanized version of the old way that people may have seen in encyclopedias or books of Mayan women are putting have a granite roller over a granite stone, and they're just going over the chocolate and combining it with cane sugar or vanilla bean. Large commercial companies use stainless steel, and we just find that the stainless steel will basically almost burn out the flavor. So we do a slow 3-day grinding process. Then we add the sugar. We have a very specific sugar philosophy. Each bean gets treated with a different sugar just for to construct like perfect flavor profiles.
When you say each bean, you're saying each bean from a country.
Right, yep.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yep, or each varietal. Our mentality is that, for instance, Madagascar has a very sort of citrusy, almost like a sour cherry flavor to it, a little bit of a raisin flavor to it, kind of winey. And I love that acidic, pure, clean flavor of it, and I don't want to disrupt it. Mm-hmm. I don't think that you necessarily need to use that raw sugar is always going to be the perfect pairing. So in this case, we use something that's a little bit more refined, something that provides sweetness, but not a lot of distracting flavor.
Walk me through the process of coming up with the name for your company. Were you considering anything else?
I think it was pretty, we knew it right away.
I've taken some business classes and in the food industry business classes and stuff like that. And they would always say, whatever you do, don't involve your name in the company, because if it goes down, you don't want your name to go down with it. There's no accountability or responsibility for anything. So that is what I think is so important about calling our company Master Brothers Chocolate and really taking the responsibility of being the face of it. The Master Brothers has other more personal and intimate implications, and that's that our father and my uncle, they're always known as the Master Brothers, and they used to just raise hell in their small town in Primgar, Iowa. And they're infamously the Master Brothers, much to their now ex-wife's dismay. I think that we also wanted to get back that name.
Talk to me a little bit about the dynamic of working with family. When you were first starting out, for example, did you know how you would get along?
On the subway ride over here, my brother and I were talking about what really is it about working with family that draws you together? And what we came up with that you will never fight for anybody harder than a family member. And you will never fight harder with anybody but a family member.
Well, we had been living together for a few years before we even took on this venture or even had a notion that we'd be starting a chocolate company together. But we had that time of about 3 or 4 years of having many fights. not just mental fights, physical fights. And you know, we got through those, and we still have those on occasion.
Is there a theme to the nature of your fighting?
We don't fight over what we say to each other more so than the way we talk to each other and the tone of how we talk to each other. And
it's always the tone. It's just the tone.
And then that just brings up, past arguments or fights that we need to steer clear of.
And of course, it's always his tone that's wrong, not mine.
Definitely always Rick's tone.
Because we know that we've survived so much like together, just growing up, and also just we've lived through arguing about way worse things than a chocolate company. Mm-hmm. So if we've survived that, we can survive anything. But that also opens the door to more arguments. Mm-hmm. Because if you think about the psychology of that, if you know somebody that you work closely with, that you know that you're going to live to see another day, no matter how you treat them, you might take advantage of that sometimes.
That's right, because you know you'll never lose them.
Exactly. Yeah.
So we cross the line more often than we should. And
welcome to therapy on NPR.
Exactly.
And also, we just had some extreme successes. We are now the restaurant Per Se is using our chocolate, and
Per Se is one of the leading restaurants in New York City. Mm-hmm.
And we have such respect for Thomas Keller and his crew that. That to me, coming from a restaurant background, is like a dream come true. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So, and we're so busy now that we used to be able to celebrate each of these new things that happened. So a couple of years ago, we would, we would celebrate
after selling 30 bars at an artist's market,
like we did, And so now we have these beautiful new things that are happening, and we don't have any time to celebrate them because we have the next thing to do, and that. That really takes a toll. You never just get to breathe and just, that was nice,
Do you have any grand visions for what you'd like the company to become? Or are you taking it more on a kind of incremental basis?
Definitely an incremental basis. It's that we've been very dedicated to that and are sticklers to that because already we've had many, many opportunities to grow super fast and build a huge factory off-site somewhere and all this kind of stuff. And we've deliberately turned it down. When we first started, we were very dedicated to slow growth. Just like food should be made slowly, with care, a company should be built under the same manner.
It's kind of like your beards.
Yeah, exactly. Slow growth. Yeah. Slightly annoying and hard to deal with it many times. It is like a beard.
It's my impression that the way you are living is very close to the way that you want to live. Is that an accurate depiction or impression that I get from you just based on the company that you're building and the website and just my interaction with you, that there's less of a distance between the way you're living and the way you want to live?
I think so. I think that's definitely accurate. I think that part of that might be just the way we grew up. being very content with what you have and appreciative of what you have. You know, we never summered anywhere. We never even heard of the word summering. So we've never desired anything like that, you know. So there's an appreciation for, A, for hard work, for working hard. And so since we're doing that, then we're pretty content. We were joking. I was joking with Stephanie, who works with us, about how I was telling her how I've organized, I just finished organizing my pantry with my wife, and everything is like in these nice mason jars. Everything is divided up by, like, you know, grains, pasta, all this stuff. And so she started thinking, wow, so your life is, you're making chocolate, then you go home with your wife and you like look through your beautiful pantry of old timey mason jars and all of this stuff. And I said, I had to stop her. I'd be like, whoa, wait. It's not, we'll, you know, we get Chinese food with the best of them. You know what I mean? When we're exhausted. So, you know, we watch, we have cable TV, you know? So,
thank you both very much for joining us.
Thanks so much.
Yeah, thanks so much for having us.
My guests have been Michael and Rick Mast, founders of Mast Brothers Chocolate, an American craft chocolate company located in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch.